You're listening to episode 6 of season 11 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, and you are listening to episode 6 of season 11 of the GNU World Order. I know, it's been months. Literally months. I think possibly 2 months since the last episode was posted, for which I apologize, but I had to move house, believe it or not. Just sort of all of a sudden. One night, we were sitting in what is now my old flat, and a landlord called up and said, "Hey, we're going to sell the property. You need to move." And so we had to find a new flat, get all of our stuff sort of packed and transported over to the new place, and then go back to the old place and clean it up so we would get our bond back, which we did. And somewhere in there, I also went to Australia on a business trip. So between all of that, it was a surprisingly busy beginning of the year for me. I did not see that coming, but that's what happened. So in this episode, we're going to talk about the Love game engine. It's a game engine written in Lua. It's kind of interesting. I just want to kind of chat about it. I'll do a quick little review of CentOS 7. Something on the Pi and take listener feedback. So let's get started. Listener feedback. Everybody wants listener feedback to be first. Well, actually, mostly I do, because if I don't do it first, right away, So this one's from Frank Bell. I know him from Linux Questions, and I think he may have emailed the show before. Maybe not. I can't remember. But yeah, Frank, I definitely sort of like know from the internet, and you may know his name as well, if you've listened to the show long enough. Frank says, and these are his words, "This was one of your best episodes. I cannot believe, by the way, that 11.5, the previous episode, was one of my best episodes. Maybe it was, but I didn't feel that way about it. But I mean, I didn't feel bad about it, but I don't feel best. But maybe it was. Frank thinks so, anyway. So he says, "I disagree with you about the use of ad blockers, though I agree with you about the obnoxious nature of ads on the World Wide Web. I visit many newspaper sites, and I want the advertisers to think that I'm reading their ads so that they continue to support journalism. I use a host's file to block, and it works quite nicely for the most grievous offenders, such as DoubleClick. This is my preferred host's, winhelp2002.mvps. .org/hosts.htm. He copies it to, of course, /etc/hosts, and it sits there and blocks incoming, or it blocks the DNS requests to go pull ads, essentially, is what that does. It sort of remaps them. Well, I haven't looked at the file, but I mean, I'm assuming that's what it's doing. So that's what Frank uses for his Etsy hosts file. If you've never blocked ads with Etsy hosts, you ought to try it. It is pretty nice. I will admit it's quite nice. I can't be bothered. It's just I would rather. This is me again, by the way. This is Klaatu. This is no longer Frank's email. I just can't. Okay, two things. First of all, I can't be bothered to look at the internet with all the ads that get scattered around, and they're so pervasive. You know, they're in rollovers, they're in pop-ups, they're in sidebars, they're just all over the place, and I honestly just can't be bothered. But that's that. The other thing about, and I'm going to disagree with Frank disagreeing with me. I don't agree that the advertisers out there are required in order for things to work. And I know that's a very sort of naive kind of thing, like, well, somebody's got to pay the bills. And I understand that somebody has got to pay the bills. But I don't believe that the advertisers always have to be the ones to pay the bills. And I believe that the advertisers shouldn't be put into the position that they own the whole house. They're not just paying the bills. They own the real estate. And I think that's what has happened to the World Wide Web. And someone, and I might have mentioned this already, but someone a long time ago mentioned that to me, you know, and said, yeah, I'm sure I mentioned this in the previous episode. They said, I will not let advertisers inside my house. They wouldn't get the internet. And that was the reason. And I thought he was crazy. But it turns out to be basically true that the advertisers are just absolutely owning lock, stock, and barrel the entire medium, rather than just sort of sponsoring content on the medium, on the media. Media? And you know, you could probably argue that the same is true for television and radio. I don't really know a whole lot about those things. But then you look at things like Netflix and other platforms with different models, and it hasn't reached that point. Now, it might reach that point. I don't know. You know, and it might be that advertising is kind of an inevitable thing that we descend into the more something scales. You know, the bigger it gets, not scales, but yeah, the more it grows, the bigger some media grows, sort of like the less it can rely upon its subscribers. I'm not really sure, but I do feel like advertisers pretty much are running the show at this point on the internet, and I don't believe that that's necessary. And, you know, like I say, it could be naive of me to say this. I haven't done a whole lot of research into it, but that is how I feel. And I guess I don't feel so in love with the internet as such, at least the World Wide Web. I don't really love it that much. So if I had to see certain things falter, I honestly wouldn't care. You know? I mean, I'm not at the point where I need those sites to exist. I mean, if you look at the stuff on the internet right now, like, a lot of it is it's all the same stuff, just being reformatted and rewritten sometimes if you're lucky. But essentially it's all the same stuff, you know? It's like the World Wide Web is busier than it looks busier than it actually is, you know? It's kind of like in Brazil, not the country, the movie. Have you ever seen Brazil? And the boss, what's his name's boss, goes into his office, and everyone turns on their little view screens and watches old movies and starts chatting with each other and just completely slacks off. And then the boss opens the door, and the minute he opens the door, everyone goes straight back to work. And then he goes back into his office, and everyone stops working again. You know, and I think that's the World Wide Web. Like, you log into you open your browser and you look at the World Wide Web, and everyone's really busy. Like, all the content creators are really busy. They're all making stuff. And then you click on, like, five different sites, and you're like, this is the same article about the same event at the same tech conference from five different perspectives, but they're all saying the same thing because they're all copying from the same press release. Maybe that's a criticism of journalism rather than a criticism of the web. But I'm skeptical, I guess, is what I'm saying. I'm not convinced as much as Frank is convinced about the necessity for advertisers. I'm open to conversation about it, though, because I don't know a whole lot about economics and stuff. And I know that people do need to get paid for working. I'm just not convinced that it's all worth it, I guess. Frank has other stuff to say, though. He says he commends the sound troubleshooting section of the previous episode for emphasizing the importance of checking the hardware. Too many people, he says persons, actually, too many persons spend hours trying to fix something in software when 2 minutes of checking hardware would reveal that the cable was loose or broken. And that is so, so true. People kind of act like telling, you know, saying to check the hardware is almost insulting. And I'm one of those people, you know, when someone says, well, did you unplug it and plug it back in or whatever. It is a little bit insulting. I mean, depending on the context, it's mostly insulting when I call up the internet provider from my home telling them that, you know, something's wrong, and it's clearly not the modem. You know, I'm speaking, I'm telling them the problem, and they'll be like, did you check the cable? And it's like, yeah, I'm telling you right now that I'm pinging you and I'm getting a delay. How would I even do that if the modem wasn't, if the cable wasn't connected? You know, that sort of thing. But in real life, like if someone says, you know, did you unplug your headphones so that you will hear the sound from your speakers, or did you forget to do that? That's a valid point. That's a valid thing, and people forget to do it. People get offended when you remind them of it. But the fact is that, like, 8 times out of 10, that is actually the problem, you know? 5 times out of 10, that's the problem. Or it's a potential problem. It is 10 times out of 10, it's a potential problem. You don't hear sound? Check the hardware. That's all we're saying. Just check the hardware. Just do it. Because once you verify that, then you can troubleshoot from that point on, resting assured that the hardware is not the problem. And that's what people don't seem to get about troubleshooting, and I don't know where I really got that myself. I don't know if it was my dad taught that to me, or if I just picked up on it, or how a lot of geeks seem to know good troubleshooting, until, obviously, their sound doesn't work. That's the really puzzling thing, is that people who know perfectly well how to troubleshoot stuff. Like they can tell you exactly why their switch is not working. Their networking switch is not working. They will be able to troubleshoot that down to the wire in the Cat5 cable. They can tell you exactly what's wrong, and yet if their sound doesn't work, they panic and run to the nearest Mac, because of course Linux can't do sound. But troubleshooting is, yeah, it's a process that builds upon itself, right? You have to get the foundation. You have to make sure that's strong. Like the most basic thing, what can we, you know, each portion of this thing we need to eliminate. The problem is not with that thing. And if you don't do certain tests, then no matter what you do above that will become meaningless. You know, if you haven't verified that the hardware works, then everything you do to try to make sound work is meaningless, because if your speaker's not on in the first place, then none of your thousands of tests after that will ever work, because your speaker's not on. And people just seem to forget that when sound is involved on Linux. I really don't understand why. And I don't know if, I don't think it's just me. I think I've seen this. I think people can identify with this. You know, anyone who's been on Linux questions can certainly identify with that. But certainly at the workplace, I was just, not my current workplace, I work from home now. But, my other workplace, it was astonishing the way people would just completely forget everything they knew about computers and Linux and common sense, and they would panic when their sound doesn't work. And that's the listener feedback. So thank you very much, Frank, for the email and for the thoughts and opinions. And now let's get on with the show. I got a little bit tired of running Debian on my Raspberry Pi. Well, I should say Banana Pi. It's not a Raspberry Pi. And if there's, before I even get started on this thing, let's go a little bit of a tangent here. The Raspberry Pi is puzzlingly difficult to get in some parts of the world. I didn't really realize this, but New Zealand, actually, we were not really getting the Raspberry Pi very promptly or at all in some cases. It's really, really odd. I don't know if they're doing something weird at the Pi Foundation, or if it's just something that is a function of being an international person now. But the Pi Zero, for instance, just came out, the year anniversary Pi Zero, or the 5-year anniversary Pi Zero. I'm not really sure. It's like the Pi Zero again. It's like $10 or something, and it's the Pi Zero. And try as I might, I just cannot find a Pi Zero here in New Zealand. And certainly the original one, I was not able to really find either. And the Pi 3, when I go to, for instance, Element 14, the New Zealand site for Element 14, when I click on the Pi 3 link to browse the Pi 3 selection, it sends me off to some other site, or it tells me that I need to find an authorized Raspberry Pi retailer in my area, or something really strange like that. And I'm not sure what that means, authorized Pi dealer. I don't know if that's like a literal authorization from the Pi Foundation, or if it's just a fancy term to say, oh, you can't buy it from us because we're in the UK or something. So it's really odd, and it's a little bit frustrating. I mean, I'm not blaming necessarily the Pi Foundation. I might be if they're the ones sort of making sure that they only sell to certain retailers, but although I guess one has to do that eventually, right? I mean, you can't. Can you? I don't know how retail works. But anyway, what I'm saying is that it's really odd that I can't get a Raspberry Pi very easily here in New Zealand. I mean, it's possible. You can do it. But it's not, it isn't like it was necessarily in the States. Although, I guess maybe it's even easier in the UK, because that is their primary market. So maybe that's the one place where you can just go to the corner store and pick up a Raspberry Pi. Anyway, that was sort of a tangent, as I said. As I warned you, fair warning. I was getting tired of running Debian on my Pi. Not really for any real reason. It was just, here's exactly what it is. I'm going to tell you finally, I'm going to actually be able to put this into words. I only have so much brain power and space, storage space in the brain. And I at some point decided I was going to learn Slackware. Got pretty good at that, if I do say so myself. And Fedora. Got pretty good at that, if I do say so myself. And those two things I'm pretty happy with. And in terms of learning, for instance, package management, I'm quite happy with what I know about those two things. I can build Slack builds, I can build RPMs, I know the command line tools for both, RPM commands, DNF commands, which are basically the same as yum commands, all the different install PKG and upgrade PKG and make PKG, stuff like that for Slackware. It's all pretty well embedded in my head at this point. And I just don't have the interest, really, or I should say the passion. I mean, there's like the theoretical interest. I would like to know everything. But when I sit down and actually try to learn something, the thing that I don't want to learn are the Debian commands. I don't want to have to navigate the apt system. Now, partly this is because I don't believe the apt system is very good. I do not think that's the best package management system I've ever experienced. And I used to have a sort of a list of complaints about it, and the longer I kind of let that simmer, I kind of realized that list of complaints is probably, there are probably equivalents, you know? One of the things that pops out at me is that apt, one of my complaints was that, well, you've got apt, well, first of all, you have apt-get and then apt-cache, and that's confusing to me. I think that's a fair complaint, but what do you know, Debian has already fixed that. They've actually reduced all of their apt blah commands to just apt. You can type apt install foo, and foo will be installed. You don't have to do apt-get install, you don't have to get apt-cache show, whatever. It's just apt install. And it does it. It works. And that's great. It's good for them. But the other thing about it was that, well, you have to apt, you can apt certain things, but then you have to drop down to dpkg for other things. And that seemed really backwards to me. But the more I kind of experienced hardcore package management on Fedora and Red Hat, I kind of felt like, well, actually, you do want to drop down to RPM sometimes. You know, if you're just doing an RPM query for some package to see if something is installed, I'm sure there's a way to do that in Yum or DNF, but one doesn't. One just does the RPM-QL whatever. Foo. So, yeah, I guess we'll kind of chill out on the whole apt criticism publicly, and I'll just say that the passion to learn apt just isn't there, and I could be completely wrong about apt, and I freely admit that I could be completely wrong. I think that's a completely fair thing to accuse me of, because the point that I'm making is that I have sort of deliberately not learned it. I just don't have the interest in learning that. So that's my point. So sitting around thinking, you know, and using Debian has been fine, but sitting around kind of thinking, I wish I could sort of consolidate all of this stuff, you know, kind of standardize this stuff. I happened to come upon the CentOS website and realized that they had released a boot image for the ARM 7 system on a chip, ARM V7, whatever it's called. And I thought, well, ARM V7 or whatever it is sounds familiar. So I looked at my Pi, and sure enough, it was that ARM version, ABI, whatever. And I thought, this sounds like it's worth doing. So I tried it out. And it turns out that the CentOS image is pretty good. But all of my standard complaints about CentOS / RHEL still apply. And that is, of course, that while it's got that really attractive, you know, what, minimum of 5-year long-term support, it really, really suffers from the lack of available packages. And you might say, well, just install EPEL, no problem. EPEL doesn't really have that many packages either, to be honest. I mean, it's a semi-official repository, sort of hosted and maintained, I think, well, not by Fedora, but I've seen it on official Fedora sites, like referenced on there, and kind of linked to from there. So it's got some kind of affiliation with Red Hat or Fedora or both. And so it doesn't really have things like FFmpeg. For that, you have to still go out to RPM Fusion. And RPM Fusion, of course, while they do some stuff for CentOS, it's not in the same league as what they offer for Fedora. I mean, their offerings for Fedora I would liken to the offerings that Debian has for Debian. It's I imagine, let's just say, tens of thousands of packages. I don't actually know that that's true, but in terms of my use case, which tends to be pretty rigorous, I've never really needed anything. You know, I've never gone to a Fedora repository, or I should say RPM Fusion repository, and said, oh, it doesn't have what I need. It's always got what I need. So lacking that on CentOS does hurt a little bit. But since this is just on a Pi, and the Pi, pretty much this particular Pi, this banana Pi, is really just a home server. That's all it is. It's pretty much my local sort of media storage center, IRC daemon, and a backup manager, I guess. It does the RDIF backup scheme that I do for all my computers to make sure that they're backing up every 4 hours. So that's all it does. It doesn't technically really need a whole lot of cool fancy toys, so I figured what I would do is install CentOS, which I did, and then for extra packages I would go out to a Fedora or an RPM repository and grab the source package for that thing, and then, or for whatever I'm looking for, and then rebuild that source package into an installable RPM targeting CentOS. That sounds like a lot of trouble, and honestly, that's not the part that's a lot of trouble. That's actually the easy part. I may have already covered this on this show before, and if so, stop me. But, I mean, it's really simple. It's all you do is you do a yum group list dash v as in verbose, I guess. And, yeah, I mean, it would be dash v as in verbose. I just don't know if that's actually what that stands for. But anyway, group list dash v, verbose. Yum, and you'll see a bunch of things, and then eventually you should see something called Fedora Packager, and you can install that, yum group install Fedora Packager. Now if you're on CentOS 7.3, that group has apparently gone away, so it would be just a yum search RPM dev. And you would install RPM dev, I think DevTools or something like that, RPM DevTools. And once you've got all that installed, you've got pretty much the makings of a building environment for RPMs. And I won't go too far into that. I've been building quite a few RPMs lately, and it's actually, the toolkit is pretty darn nice. But I will say that in order to rebuild the RPM, all you have to do is rpm build dash dash rebuild foo.rpm or whatever whatever RPM you've downloaded, and it repackages that RPM into a, in this case, CentOS 7 .rpm. There's a couple of steps in between there, like you have to get the source RPM that you want to rebuild. But that's pretty simple. You just go to the Fedora or the RPM Fusion repository, and instead of, I go like online, actually. I navigate in the browser and find the package that I want online, and download the source RPM. And then I put that source RPM into a folder called RPM Build. Now, the RPM Build folder you don't actually have to make yourself. You can just have your RPM dev tools do that for you. And it's a specific command. It's RPM dev dash setup tree. That's RPM dev dash setup tree. That command, when you execute it, the only reason it exists is to create an environment for you to build RPMs. So it dumps into your home directory a folder called RPM build, and in that folder there are five subfolders, subdirectories. There's one called build, one called RPMs, one called sources, one called specs, and one called SRPMs. So you can put your source RPM into the SRPMs subdirectory if you want. I mean, that would make sense to me. And then execute the RPM build space dash dash rebuild space, and then the path. So let's just say you're in the RPM dev or RPM tree. So you would say SRPM s/ foo dot FC24, because let's say you got it out of the Fedora 24 repository, dot SRC.RPM, because that's what source RPMs are named. And it will do everything from there. It unpacks that RPM, it looks at the spec file, figures out what needs to happen, and rebuilds that RPM for you, and dumps it into your RPM tree. your RPM build tree into the RPMS folder. The weird thing about the RPMS folder, I guess, is that it inside of the RPMs folder is will be a bunch of different architectures, and that used to throw me off. Well, still does if I forget about it. It throws me off because I'm thinking, well, I'm on an x86-64 system, so where's my RPM? It's not in the x86-64 subfolder in RPMs. Well, maybe it's a no arch. If it's a no arch, like a Perl script or a Bash script or something that you're packaging up, then it's going to be a no arch. It won't be in the architecture that you're in. So that's something to keep in mind. But it might be in the architecture. It just depends on what you're building, obviously. But yeah, that's where it is. And that's how you rebuild an RPM. Now, like I say, that's not the hard part. It's just RPM, or rather yum install RPM dev tools, and then RPM dev dash setup tree, and then you grab the source RPM from the internet, dump it into your home directory or into your RPM build tree, rather, and then you rebuild it, and that's it. It just made you an RPM that you can now install. It's really, really simple. Not a big deal. So the hard part becomes when you are trying to install a package that is dependent upon a lot of other things, and a lot of those other things are also not in CentOS. Now you've got this RPM rebuild thing, and it's going to want to do whatever it needs to do, possibly. I mean, it depends again on what kind of package it is, but it may need to pull in other things so that it can rebuild this RPM for your system. But if it doesn't have access to those packages, then now you're going to have to go out and get those packages and rebuild them. So it becomes your own special retro version of RPM torture, which people used to talk about all the time. You know how RPM, I think that's one of the things that kind of still to this day holds it back, is that a lot of people have probably very valid, I mean, I can speak very comfortably about RPMs because I never had a bad experience with them. I never went through the time before yum. So some people remember when they had to hunt down dependencies and would run into all kinds of conflicts, and would they weren't able to find a dependency, or they would find a thing, but then they would try to install that, but it depended on the thing that was also depending on it, so there was that circular dependency. You know, you get horror stories about that. You've heard them, I'm sure. I hear them all the time. People just love to kind of like talk about that. Oh, I remember back in the day, you know, and it's like, yes, I know. And I'm sure that's all very, very valid, and I can't really say anything about that because I wasn't there. I didn't have to suffer through that. I have no street cred in that department, and I recognize that. But my reality is that I don't live in that time, and this is working quite well for me. But if you switch to CentOS on your Pi and you want something that CentOS does not have in its repositories, then you get to sort of relive that experience if you're going to try to do this all by hand. Now again, I'm currently perfectly happy taking that risk because my Pi right now doesn't really do a whole lot other than just kind of, well, like I say, it backs stuff up and it sort of serves files, and that's pretty much what, and it runs IRC, and that's pretty much what it does. It's not that big of a deal. I don't really need a whole lot from it right now. If it was a more active computer where I was doing unexpected things on it every day, I might not be able to run CentOS on it. So that's my standard very long CentOS caveat, and it's an annoying caveat because I keep making it, and people keep sort of saying, oh, well, you know, you don't need to do that, you should just run Fedora. And then you look at the Fedora release cycle and support cycle, and you think, I don't really want to do that. And And it's a weird, weird problem to have. And yeah, if I ever get really, really confounded by it, I might, you never know, I might throw OpenSUSE on a Pi and see how that goes, because I know that OpenSUSE has a really good support cycle as well, and I've used SUSE on a Pi before just to mess around with, and I quite liked it. I quite like Zipper. So yeah, you never know. But for now, CentOS it's running quite nicely. It's everything that I hoped it would be. I mean, it's you know, perfect pretty much. No complaints. So if you're looking for a long-term support style release for your Raspberry Pi, you might want to check out CentOS. If you're looking for a dedicated, sort of an appliance style Pi, which I'm often doing with my Pis, they're often being offloaded into some kind of art project or, you know, doing something somewhere that's kind of in a kiosk mode, and that's usually not for my stuff, it's usually for someone else's stuff that I'm building for them. But CentOS is really good for that too, because the CentOS image that they distribute is pretty darn minimal, so it's like you don't have to really carve too much out in order to get it to a really fast boot and just kind of a single purpose Arduino stand-in pretty much. So yeah, check that out. CentOS for the Pi. It is here, and it is good. I forget who. I saw an email or a post in IRC or something asking me how the Pocket Chip was treating me, and the Pocket Chip is treating me quite well still, really. The Pocket Chip is great. I have nothing really to add to what, you know, all the wonderful things that I said about it already. It's just, it's really a solid little device. I'm really, really enjoying it, and honestly, like, in terms of casual use computing, lightweight computing, I would say that it easily gives the Pi a run for its money, because it is just so darn portable and self-contained. It's really, really nice. But I don't want to keep going on about that, because I've already talked about that in an episode, episode 4 or 3 or so of this series, so go back and listen to that if you haven't. But I wanted to amend that a little bit with two things. Well, one thing. Anyway, one thing is that you can, that some user out there wrote an add-on to the launch screen so that you can change icons, which I think earlier I had said there was a hack that you could do to do that, and it wasn't very easy, and so on and so on. But someone's modded that and sort of improved it, and I don't know how. You can apparently add it with apt, so you can get it fairly easily. I have not tried yet, so I don't know. It might turn out that, you know, the devs have disappeared by now. I don't know. There's this weird thing that goes on in some corners of the internet where people develop and version control and release and bug report all in a forum. And it's not even a dedicated forum. It's like somebody else's forum. I've seen this a couple of times now. It's kind of like, if you go out looking for game mods, like, you know, new texture packs for some studio game that exists on Steam or something, then you'll find a lot of those people are doing that sort of thing. They'll be like, oh, I've released new HD quality texture packs that you can, replace the stock textures that came with such and such a game. You can put these textures in, or something even cooler, you know, like I've done this cool script that changes options when you get a companion in this game. It gives this, you know, it gets these new abilities, or you know, stupid things like, you know, eternal, you know, endless lives, or whatever, you know, whatever mods do these days. I was just looking for textures, but you know what mods are for video games. They're just like old school hacks for cheat codes, you know, for games, except modernized. So, yeah, they do that. A bunch of the Android hacking stuff does that. You know, you'll go out and look for an Android image for some specific phone or device, and you'll end up at this, yeah, a forum in a forum posting about something else, and this guy suddenly hijacked the thread with, "Hey, everybody, I've got this new image for this specific phone," and then someone writes back and says, "Oh, it works, but there's this problem. Okay, I'll change it. Okay, I've changed it. Now I've uploaded it again." You know, and it's just all in the forum. And so, yeah, the chip kind of suffers from this as well, apparently. The user forums of the pocket chip, the chip in the pocket chip, you'll find all kinds of cool stuff, except in the, you know, essentially the wrong place, like the worst place in the world. Like, don't do this in forums. Like, announce it in a forum and then have everything happen on GitLab or GitHub or some site, you know, SourceForge, some site that is meant for development and feedback. That would make much more sense. Really. The Raspberry Pi actually has some of that going on too. There was this whole big long thread about a scratch fork that had happened, and it was huge, and for literally 2 years, from 2015 up until now, there was it's just this all development on this one port of Scratch 2 back to Squeak, or Squeak, whatever that VM is all in that forum. It's crazy. So anyway, the Pocket Chip, doing great, has a launcher screen mod that you can find if you really look hard enough for it. But the thing that sort of got me thinking about programming, actually, was this annoyance about the chip that it happens to come with this little game engine called Pico 8, P-I-C-O-8, unrelated to the text editor, as far as I know, and it's closed source. The Pico 8 engine is not an open source engine. It is a closed source piece of software. And somehow, for whatever reason, the Pocket Chip people made a deal with the Pico 8 people back before the thing was even released, saying that, yeah, every chip, every Pocket Chip, every chip, whatever, would ship with this program called Pico 8. And the Kickstarter forums, you know, as you would expect, we're a little bit mixed. Some people, including myself, lobbied against it. It was kind of like, not really interested in having a closed source binary blob dropped into our chip image that we're kickstarting under the impression that it's an entirely open source platform. And, you know, open hardware, open software, like the whole thing was open, but there's like this glaring closed source application that's being sort of touted and advertised and given to us for free. And don't you love these closed source gifts that people give now? It's sort of like open source has become, I guess, so ubiquitous at this point that closed source and copyrighted material are being, I can't say the word given away, because number one, it's not accurate, and number two, it's things that people do not want, you know? They are things that are just showing up. They're kind of being dumped at your doorstep, I guess is the phrase. People are like dumping these things on us, and it's closed source or it's non-Creative Commons. And we get to deal with it, you know? And it's just kind of like, I don't want this. I got off of this stuff. I don't do this anymore. I don't need this. I don't want it. Take it away. People aren't taking it away, you know? They're giving it to you whether you asked for it or not. It's just popping up on your devices. And it's kind of funny to me that that's where closed source is now. And yet, people still really like closed source. Like, there's still a pretty good contingency out there, from what I can tell, from what I've heard, of people who really, really like the closed source stuff. It's really bizarre to me. It's a weird twist, you know? It's kind of like, well, you can't beat us if we're, you know, if we don't charge for anything. And closed source people are kind of like, well, yes, we can. We can force people to own our stuff and never actually give them the right to fully own it. Just make them house it for us. And we won't charge them for it. I just never saw that one coming. That seems weird to me. But I mean, look at Windows 10, right? I mean, I don't know if you can buy it yet, but for a very long time, it was being given away. You know, similarly, from what I understand, I think at some point you sort of had to upgrade or something like that. Like, people were complaining that they'd gotten upgraded by surprise to Windows 10. Of course, people also complained that I don't know. That they didn't realize Ubuntu wasn't Windows. I mean, people are people, right? So take that for whatever it is. But it is kind of funny that closed source is doing this. So anyway, back to the topic at hand. Pico 8 came on the Pocket Chip, whether you wanted it or not, and I certainly didn't want it. So I was kind of annoyed by that, low level annoyance. Because I mean, I didn't have to use it. It's just weird that I had to have it on my device. So it's 2 megabytes or whatever it is. It's not a big deal, but still didn't really want it. So I was kind of looking around for alternatives. Again, not that I actually needed the thing. I was just curious. It was just kind of like one of those, why did we get Pico 8 when I'll bet you anything there's something else out there? And my first thought, as yours probably is, if you know anything about Pico 8, which you may not, but it's a super simple game engine, okay? So the idea is that people, presumably kids, but probably also hipsters, who are older than kids, but younger than real people, they can, you know, program little games and bit, you know, pixel art things, you know, creations. Creative things. And that's cool, you know? Like, that's a cool idea. I like that. But the fact that it was all closed source, I liked a lot less. And of course, it's one of those weird, like, closed source things where it's, oh, we're closed source, but we're all about sharing and love and giving things away and building a community. And it's just like, well, yeah, but you're still closed source. You're still hoarding the bulk of the thing that you are trying to build this community around. And I don't understand why people don't get offended by that. You know, it's weird. It puzzles me when that happens, because I think it's very obvious. Like, but you're being greedy and you're asking everyone to jump aboard this gravy train that doesn't actually have any gravy in it. I don't even know if that makes any sense. So I was looking around for an alternative, because I did want to see if there was something similar. And the first thing I thought of is was Pygame. Because, I mean, Pygame, right? It's Pygame. Pygame, everybody knows Pygame. It's Python. It's a game engine for Python. And I've used it a lot. I've used it for little silly games, you know, that no one should ever have to watch, or much less play. But I've also used it for practice, surely. I've learned a lot of Python through Pygame. But also for like little weird art things, art projects. I kind of used it probably too much. There were times when I loaded up Pygame knowing completely, you know, deep down knowing that there was absolutely no reason that I needed the whole Pygame stack for what I was doing. But, I mean, heck, I wanted to play some music, and I wanted to detect key presses. And, I mean, honestly, like, one of the easiest ways to do that is just put Pygame on your Raspberry Pi or whatever, and you're done. You've got everything you need right there. So I did use Pygame a lot. I have used it. I will probably continue to use it. I like it. It's a pretty good little game engine. That said, it is very, very, it is very object-oriented. It is very, it can be very complex, I guess, is what I want to say. It is very, to get just sort of like a really basic little game going, there's a lot of code. Which is not a criticism, because it's a realistic expectation. That's not a crazy thing, that Pygame requires hundreds of lines of code to get a really basic, you know, like, bananas falling from the sky and a monkey is catching them kind of game. You know, that level of, like, get the good jewels and avoid the bad jewels or whatever, you know, it takes a lot of code, and not only does it take, like, a lot of lines of code, it takes a lot of structure. And I think that's what I meant, yeah, that structure. You really have to think about, like, okay, I want this class of an item, and I need it to respond in certain ways if something collides with it, so that's going to take a different function within that class. And then when I call that class, here's how I'm going to call it, you know, and what's the difference between calling a class and just a variable that you created? How do you get information out of a class? It's a big kind of, you have to understand a lot about programming. And I feel like that's a little bit difficult to wrap your head around if you're just getting started with programming. And I'm not 100% sold on this. It might just be that I personally don't know yet the best way to teach Pygame, which is quite possible. I have taught it before, and I did find it a little bit heavy. It was a lot to try to convey to people. Once you started getting into the actual kind of, like, this is going to be a real game now with, like, graphics and stuff. Like, that, at that point, it became very, very heavy to try to explain to people. So I was looking for something a little bit simpler than Pygame. And I stumbled upon this thing called the Love Engine, L-O with two dots over it. Was that... Is that an umlaut? I don't know. Two dots over at VE, Love. And you can find it at love2d.org. And Love, the Love game engine, is apparently semi-directly competing with Pico 8. That is how I found it anyway. I don't know. I now that I'm saying it aloud, I don't really remember seeing on their website that they're, like, going head-to-head with Pico 8. But when I was looking around the internet for alternatives to Pico 8, Love came up a lot, and it seemed like a lot of people kind of saw that as a competitor of Pico 8. So, it is a Lua-based game engine, which is really, really interesting for a couple of reasons. One, because Lua, if you've ever looked into getting a job at a video game place, which for a while I was like, well, maybe it could be cool to, like, look for a job somewhere at a video game company. That could be a fun gig. And if you do look around, you'll see that Lua is all over the place. Like, it's just everywhere. And that's not, like, in open source gaming. I'm talking about, like, just gaming. Like, the gaming world has a lot of Lua in it. You can look for it in the splash screens of the loading screens, like when you're booting up a game, starting up a game, you'll see Lua sometimes. Otherwise, you'll just see it in a listing of, you know, like, licenses and stuff, Or maybe you won't see it at all. But like I say, if you look for a video game job, or game in a job in the video game industry, you do tend to see a lot of Lua popping up. So Lua's pretty popular, and it's pretty popular within the gaming community, so it really kind of makes a lot of sense for it to have a game engine, because if you're going to get started with something, you might as well get started with the thing that you're going to end up using in your career. So that was kind of interesting. And then the second thing about it is that it's a 2D engine. It is pretty simple. It's not, you know, when you look at the API for it, it's not super overwhelming. I will also say it doesn't have the best documentation in the world. I will say that right now. It does not have the best documentation in the world. So be aware of that. I'm not saying it's the worst or anything like that. I'm just saying that I have definitely seen better. And that's a bit of a problem. I would say, personally, I think I would say that Pygame has better documentation. The weird thing about Pygame is that the documentation does tend to be very documentation-y, like code documentation-y, you know? It's kind of like you look at it, and if you're not familiar with the concept of a class and methods, then it all looks just completely like gibberish. And that, on one hand, is fine, because realistically, when you do understand classes and methods and things like that, then suddenly you will think, oh, well, this totally makes sense now. But for those new users who are just trying to figure out, well, how do I apply a collision detection here, then suddenly it becomes like this just huge problem of how to understand these concepts, and there's not necessarily any explanation for that. And I won't say Love does a whole lot better than that. And I keep thinking, and I'm saying it because I keep feeling like Love would be a pretty good contender for like those new programmers out there, but without the documentation that just speaks down to people, you know? Just explain it like you're 8-year-old or whatever the expression is. That's what it needs. And maybe that's what it'll get at some point. It's open source, so certainly instead of talking about it on a podcast, I could just go implement it. And actually, to that end, I am working on a little bit of documentation for it. But I think hopefully, ideally, there will be a bigger and better community around it. Now myself imposed, I'm imposing this upon them myself. I'm seeing Love as kind of a successor, as the next logical step to a Scratch programming class, or I should say, series of Scratch programming classes. And Scratch, I have seen, I've witnessed it myself. I've taught two classes on Scratch to very little kids, not by myself. I was helping someone else, but we taught Scratch to very small children, and it goes really, really well. I mean, kids take to Scratch really, really well. They love it, they understand it, and then they start building upon it. I mean, not all of them do. Some of them never really build upon what you show them. And those are either not going to be, those kids are not going to be programmers, or they're late bloomers. And as a very, very late bloomer myself, a lifelong late bloomer myself, I can identify with that. So I'm not saying that they'll never do anything technical with their lives, although if they don't, that's okay too. But I'm just saying, you know, don't write them off. But anyway, these are theoretical kids anyway. We can write anybody off. It doesn't matter. They don't exist. But the kids who do exist do love Scratch. They learn a lot, and they grow with it. But at some point, like, you know, my partner, girlfriend, person teaches Scratch, and she's got at least, I would say, 3 years of Scratch courses that she does, you know, so for kids, like, they get 3 years of Scratch, 3 years of constant Scratch, and that's a lot of years of Scratch. And you might think, well, that's too many years of Scratch, but it's actually not, because Scratch is surprisingly robust, and the more that kids start wanting to do more with it, you know, the more they want to push Scratch as an engine, the more they have to learn about programming, because you just can't do certain things without learning about, for instance, variables. You know, at some point you're going to have to finally create your own variables and store stuff in there, and at some point you may even have to learn how to create a list and get values from that list and things like that. So it's really good, and at the point where someone has finally hit the ceiling of Scratch, that's where I see people needing to flip over into something that makes them type out text and really understand what programming's actually all about. And it's going to be a painful transition, but there's no avoiding that. It's going to be painful. You could argue probably that Scratch just isn't the right introduction, but for some people I think it probably is the right introduction. But at some point, yeah, people are going to hit the ceiling of Scratch's ability, and they have to do something else. So, and people point out to me all the time, like, well, look at this Super Mario clone done entirely in Scratch. It's really amazing. But it's all programmed. Like, you know, it wasn't done with the Scratch building block, like, you know, building block code, drag and drop, visual basic style coding, you know, like, or, is it visual basic? I don't know. But, you know, where you're dragging blocks around and stacking them onto each other to make routines that get cycled through. It just doesn't, it's not the same thing. It's different at the point of, you know, someone creating entirely new blocks, really. So at some point Scratch gets outgrown and you need something new to dump people into. And I'm forcing love into that role, sort of. It's like in my own mind. I haven't actually, you know, introduced anybody to this yet, but for me, in my mind, if someone says, well, little Timmy's very good on Scratch, but now he wants to go to the next level. Where should he go? Well, I would then guide little Timmy over to love2d.org and tell him to figure that out, which he would not be able to do on his own. So it's not super. This is a real programming language, but it is easier, I think, than Pygame. And here's why I think that. It's a little bit like processing. If you've ever used processing.org, which is a Java subset, or processing.org is the site, but the processing language is what it's called. It's a horrible name for a language, processing. And it's a subset of Java, and it's built specifically for graphical things, you know? It's like, oh, look at the cool things that you can make appear on your screen, and you can export it to Android, so you can actually build, like, Android apps on it and all kinds of cool stuff. Well, Love goes one better, and you can actually use Love, the game engine, on all the computing platforms that you can think of, plus Android, plus, believe it or not, iOS. I've obviously not tried to install it on iOS, but it apparently can be done. Like, you can download the Love2D game engine, and then any Love file that you distribute can then be run on that device. Love files are distributed as game.love. That's the extension is .love, .love. And all that is a zip file. So to distribute your game, to package your game up, all you do is zip all the contents of your game project, your project folder. So all your Lua files and then all your game assets, stuff like that, you just zip it up. Main.lua has to be at the top level of your zip archive. So there's that requirement. So it can't be like the zip container holding a directory that holds all of your Lua files. It needs to be a zip container holding at least main.lua, and then from there you can have whatever structure you want. But main.lua has to be on the top level. Okay, enough talk. Let's do a quick hello world. So, to install Love2D, you just use your package manager, believe it or not, and install Love. So yeah, yum install I think just love, like literally love. It might be Love 2D. I don't exactly remember, but yes, it's quite simple to install, and that's on, you know, anything, Slackware, Fedora, Debian, whatever. So install that, and then you're ready to go. And all you do is open up a text editor, and you can do all the usual things, like you can make a variable. For instance, canvas wide equals 520. Canvas high equals 333. So you've just made two variables, one for the canvas width and one for the canvas height. We'll use that in a little bit. You can do things like setting the window title, like love.window.setTitle, with a capital T, parentheses, quote, hello world, close, quote, close parentheses. And then you can set the dimensions of the window with love.window.setMode, with a capital M, and then parentheses, and of course then you would call your variables in, which would be C, or canvas wide, comma, canvas high, close parentheses. So the variables that we created up there at the top were global variables. If you wanted them to be local just to this file, you would call it a local canvas wide, local canvas height, which really we could do, because we're creating our window in this file, so we could have called them local variables. But for now, we'll just leave it as is. Okay, so there are three main functions that are built in to Love, to the engine, that you pretty much almost always need. You certainly need, I shouldn't say need. I'll say that you'll almost always use. There are three. There's Love Load, there's Love Update, and there's Love Draw. Love Load is kind of that init function that you would see in, well, certainly Python. That's the thing, or like in your void setup, you know, in like Java, or in processing specifically, or whatever. It's the init thing. It's the thing that when you launch the application, that thing gets executed. So that's function, the word function, love.load, parentheses, parentheses, because we're not giving it any arguments. We're just calling love load. And in this love load function, what we'll do is set the background color. So we'll do a love.graphics.setBackgroundColor with a capital B and a capital C, and then parentheses, and then you can enter some RGB value. So 177, comma, 33, comma, 0, parentheses. So now you've just set the background color of your window. You could also create define a font, rather. So font equals love.graphics.setNewFont, with a capital N and a capital F, parentheses, quote, ibmnuvo.ttf, close quote, comma, 72, close parentheses. So in that case, what we're doing is we're using the love.graphics module to create a new font, or rather to instantiate a new font, which of course we would have to have in our love game that we're distributing. So luckily I have Nouveau IBM.ttf on my computer, and I will copy it into my current project directory. And now Love, you know, the my game is now aware that Nouveau IBM.ttf is available to it, and it is aware that its size should be 72. And then you close out a function with the word end, END. So the next line I would just type END. Now, if there was anything happening in my little Hello World application, I would then create here a function.update, a function rather, love.update, parentheses, DT, delta, tango, close parentheses. Now the update function is the loop. It's the thing that's happening constantly as your game runs. That's the runtime of your game. So if in Python or Pygame you're thinking of your game clock, which I've suddenly like just instantly forgotten what the actual name of that module is, but that's, you know, it's the ticking of the timer of your game. Now, in this little simple Hello World application, I wouldn't need an update. I don't need an update because there's nothing. I'm not going to do any motion or anything. I just want to draw a window and draw some text into it. So we'll skip the function love.update for now. So the final function of my little Hello World would be function love.draw parentheses parentheses. And then in the love.draw function, I'll do love.graphics.setColor, capital C, parentheses 255, comma 250, comma 72, close parentheses. I'm just making up numbers. And then the next line will be love.graphics.print, parentheses, quote, hello world, close quote, comma, and then maybe I'd use my canvas width, or my canvas wide divided by 4, comma, canvas high divided by 3.5, close parentheses. So I'm just taking the width of the canvas, and I'm dividing it by 4 and saying, okay, start my text there for the x value, and then I'm taking the height of my canvas and dividing it by 3 and saying, okay, stick my text approximately there. So it should be about midway down the window, a little bit less than midway. And then I can end that function, so END. And that would be that. That's it. That's main.lua. Save that as main.lua, and then use zip to zip that up into something called game. Well, I guess you should do game.zip. So here's the command. You do it zip. Let's do game.zip main.lua space ibmnouveau.ttf, or whatever font file you're using. Or if you don't have a font file handy, you can just comment the font line out with two dashes. Two dashes equals a comment in love. So dash dash space font. Now it's commented out. But you should have a font somewhere on your system that you can copy to your directory. Zip that up. And that zips both main.lua and the font file into one container called game.zip. And then move game.zip to game.love. So rename it to game.love. And now if you type in love.game.love, it will launch a window with some who knows what color background, with who knows what color of font, text saying hello world to you. And that's the hello world of love. And that's more or less the structure of the sort of the obviously the basics of the engine, meaning that the setup, you kind of establish the players of your game, as it were, sort of like the elements of your game, I should say, and then in the draw you make sure that those elements actually get rendered onto screen. But then in update you get to do all the things that you want to do, you know, sort of as the game is played. And that's obviously where it gets a little bit more complicated. Now, you're not just restricted to three functions. You can make your own functions. So, you know, you can make your sprites, for instance, change direction. Like if they're walking to the right part of the screen along a platform and you want to turn them around, you hit the left arrow or the A key on your keyboard. Then they shouldn't just back up, right? They should flip. The avatar should flip around. So, for that kind of action, you would need your own function, and you might call it, you know, function rotate, or player rotate, or something like that. And within that function, you could load a different, image for your avatar. And that's something I don't want to go too deep into the love engine, because I mean, there's only so much I can sort of narrate to you, but one interesting thing about the way that it's structured is that all of the major elements in the love engine, they're arrays, really. They're just Lua arrays. So in Pygame, when you have a thing that you want to instantiate, you have to pretty much you can expect that you're going to build a class. And that's fine, and there may be an equivalent of that in Love. I've not been using it that long. But in Love, when you're creating something that's going to pop up on screen and do something, you're actually just creating an array that gets a bunch of attributes thrown into it. And that's kind of, that's your thing. And that's a really, I have really liked this model, and I think that there's a lot of, I think it breaks down a lot of the confusion about how to create something with different attributes. I mean, I guess that's not the hard part. I mean, the hard part is how to get to those attributes after you've created them. And it's honestly not that different from Pygame and Love, and yet it feels totally different. Let me just tell you exactly how it's done. I guess there is actually a major difference now that I'm stammering on about it. It's that in Pygame, when you use a class, obviously you have to create an instance of that class. And from there, generally speaking, you can just kind of call attributes out of that class. But I feel like that's a really hard concept for people to grasp. Whereas in Love, what you would do, for instance, here's a simple little an example. Let's say you've got a penguin that you're going to create on screen. So penguin, you would create it as a variable at the top of your, you know, probably a global variable, because it's probably something that's going to span several files. It's probably going to have to interact with several different things. So we would say penguin equals brace brace, curly bracket. Okay, so now we've created an empty array called penguin. Now in your function love.load area, you can start throwing attributes into this array. So you could say, for instance, player.x equals 0, player, not player, penguin.x equals 0, penguin.y equals 0. So what do we know now? Well, we know that penguin is going to be rendered at an x value of 0 and a y value of 0. So that means that the penguin will appear on our screen at the top left corner of our little game screen. But we don't really have anything appear yet, right? So we would need to give it some kind of costume. If you're a Scratch graduate, you would call it a costume. So, because we're going to make Penguin a sprite, so we want it to look like, you know, we want there to be an image there. So you could do penguin.img, for instance, equals love.graphics.newImage, parentheses, quote, images/penguin.png, close quote, close parentheses. Similar to when we were building a font, you have this value, in this case it's penguin.img, and you're assigning it to the output of love.graphics.newImage, parentheses, and then the path to the image that you want to appear to represent the penguin object on your screen. So that's really easy to explain to people, you know? It's kind of like, well, it's its own reinforcement, because you're repeating a lot of things. You know, you're doing like the penguin.x equals penguin.y equals penguin.img equals. It's always the same kind of, like, anytime someone has a question, how do I do this? You can kind of point back to the thing that they did earlier and just kind of point, and they'll get it. And that's a good teaching tool. That's really, really good. So if you assign all of those attributes to your penguin array, you're essentially building an object. So you're kind of doing an object-oriented type of thing there. And I know people will yell at me now because I've called an array an object-oriented type of thing. Because I've done that before, and I know people are very particular about what object-oriented is, but I'm just saying that this array represents this sprite, and so you're dumping all of these attributes into that array, and you can kind of think of that sprite as a thing, as an item in your game. Now that's just loading it. That's kind of just, that's instantiating the thing and making sure that it's available within your project when you actually want to use it at some point later. You don't really usually use the object necessarily in the load function. So the things that you would probably do in the, well, certainly the first thing that you would do is, or the first thing I would do, is go down to the love.draw function, function love.draw, and make sure that the image of the penguin is getting drawn onto the screen in whatever location we want it to be drawn. One cool thing is that you can have it stick to your mouse. That's easy. So in love.draw, you could do a love.graphics.draw parentheses penguin.img. Remember, we defined penguin.img up in the love load so that we our array definitely contains a penguin.img, which has been assigned the little png that we got off of, you know, openclipart.org or wherever we got our graphics, comma, love.mouse.getPosition parentheses parentheses, and then close the parentheses for the graphic draw. So love.mouse.getPosition, as you can imagine, is the mouse module for the Love game engine, and one of the many things that the mouse module can do is get the position of the cursor. So in this case, it is going to, even though we have assigned a penguin.x and a penguin.y, it's going to pretty much ignore that stuff and draw the penguin icon or graphic over wherever our mouse cursor is. So that's good. Then in love update, which we haven't used in our hello world, so we could add one for this, we could do a function love.update parentheses dt, that's delta tango, close parentheses. So that's our clock. This is our little ticking timer giving us our frame rate per second kind of, you know, actual real-time interaction. We could do a love.graphics.draw again, because, again, this is being updated, right? This is always being updated. Every tick, this is being performed. So love.graphics.draw, parentheses, penguin.img, comma, love.mouse.getPosition, parentheses, parentheses, close parentheses. So in the love.draw function, we made sure that the penguin.img gets drawn onto the canvas. So that's actively being managed, if you will, by the canvas. And then in the love update, we're saying, okay, every time you go through this update function, every time you loop through this function, make sure that you're redrawing the penguin.img at whatever position my mouse happens to be. So now if you were to launch that, and you had a, well, you would have to zip it up and you'd have to have a penguin.png saved somewhere on your, you know, in your project folder. So the command would probably be something like zip, game.zip, main.lua, penguin.png, and, IBM nouveau, or nouveau underscore IBM, whatever it was, .ttf. And that would zip up our, the font file that we need for the hello world text. It would zip up the penguin graphic, and it would do our main.lua file. And then if we changed the name to that, of that to game.love, then you could do love.slash/game.love, and now you'll have a penguin icon following your mouse around. And it's as simple as that. The next logical step would obviously be to take the penguin and sort of wrap a bounding box around it so that we could have it run into things maybe, or we could draw a fish on the screen, and the object of the game could be to get the fish with your penguin, because that's pretty logical, you know, sort of a feeding frenzy type game. or we could make a platform and have fish fall from the sky, and then you could move the penguin around maybe just along the x-axis and gobble up the good fish and discard the bad fish, whatever. I mean, the sky is obviously the limit. I'm just coming up with sort of off the top of my head ideas to get started, you know, with Love Engine. But I think you kind of get a pretty good feel for how it works. The reason I'm not zipping straight to a game.love file, by the way, is that the zip tool doesn't seem to really do all that well with zipping to non.zip extensions. It seems to get pretty confused. It also doesn't seem to be doing well right now, at least the version of zip that's on my computers. Doesn't seem to be respecting the dash capital D, delta, flag, like the dash dash no dash directory, no dir dash entries. So, like, if you want to put your assets into a separate folder and then zip them all at the top level, I can't get zip to not create directories inside of the zip container. Really, I wish zip would just go away. I much prefer tar and gz, and I never really cared all that much one way or the other, but now that I'm actually interacting with zip a little bit more often, it's really quite unpleasant. I might try 7-zip at some point just to see if love can understand that instead. But I just never got around to it. Anyway, that was sort of a side note. Point being, the Love Engine is really cool. It's really I don't want to say it's really simple, because that's not true. It's got a lot of features. It's really quite nice, is what it is. It's nice. It's a nice engine, and I got moderately familiar with it over just the course of a weekend. For some of you who have been programming a lot longer than me, it would probably even take less. Certainly if you're used to Lua, it would probably even take less than that. So, yeah, it's not hard to learn, really, and it does seem to be more or less on par with something like Pygame. In terms of feature set, you know, like, I haven't really found anything so far in Love 2D that I can think of doing that I don't know already also exists in Pygame. And for things that the Love Engine may be lacking, and I'm not even sure if Pygame has this stuff, but there are extra modules out there. Like, there's a physics... physics is built in, sorry. Collider. There's a collision library, HC, the library for detecting collisions, a little bit better than what Love Engine accounts for. With the Love Engine itself does have a B-box, bounding box function, but it's, from what I've read on their wiki, the one page that they have on it, like I say, their documentation ain't all that great. The bounding box maybe is a little bit rudimentary for, you know, really good collision detection. So the HC library is a little bit easier / better / more robust to use. You could also use the physics library and that kind of enforces collisions, because you have sort of physical bodies that you create and move around. I don't really know how to get, I haven't really tried, but I don't really know how to detect the collision yet. I just know that it does collide. It just happens to collide. So you can bump into things and move things around, but that doesn't necessarily mean that, I don't really know how to necessarily know that you've bumped into something. So I don't know if you could, like, you know, if you wanted to remove health for having bumped into or crossed a pit of lava or something, then or hot coals or something, maybe lava, you'd probably just fall in and burn, but hot coals, then how would you detect that you're touching that subject, that substance? So I'm not really sure how extensive the physics library is, but the HC collision library has been quite useful. It's on GitHub. It's referred to a couple of places. So yeah, it's a good little engine, and it has a bunch of sort of little Lua extensions lying around if you look for them. So it doesn't feel like it would be a compromise to sort of wander away from Pygame if you're looking for something simple and fun to use. Not that Pygame is not fun to use, but it is, I believe it's more complex. I think teaching the Love game engine to a person with little to no programming might be easier than teaching them Pygame. That's how I feel about it. I could be wrong, but that's my impression, and that's kind of what I'm going to theorize for a little while and see if I can teach a couple of people a little bit of the Love game engine. And you notice how I'm not falling into the trap of saying goofy things like, I'm going to see if I can teach people some Love. See, I'm not saying that. I'm very specifically saying Love game engine. So yes, I'm going to teach some people the Love game engine. Or if I can find someone to teach. But yeah, I'm going to try it and see how they take to it, because I really am curious to see what the learning curve is like compared to, you know, on the low end Scratch, and then on what we'll call the high end for our purposes, Pygame. That's it. So check it out, love2d.org.